Both Texas senators, the land commissioner, the lieutenant governor, nearly every statewide office had a rogue Republican inside it. What he did in 25 years is remake the political face of Texas and give shape and substance to a ruling political class, Bill Miller told me. In 1994, Texas elected its last statewide Democrat. It was a complete rout of a political party, Miller said. I asked Carl where he thought the Republican Party in Texas, which he had done so much to create, was headed. Look at the House, he said. Jonathan Stickland and the Freedom Caucus are a minority faction. The only reason that they got that much traction this session is that Joe Strauss didn't have his act together. He pointed out that there is still a bipartisan tradition in the legislature. This was true even under the extremely conservative Speaker Tom Craddock, who was overthrown by the coup that put Strauss in the Speaker's chair. Joe's election, I hope, portends the future, Rove said, where you have a reasonable Republican who's backed by reasonable Democrats, with the partisan extremists pushed to the sidelines. About 1,100 new laws went into effect after the 2017 legislative session. Among them, children under the age of 16 will no longer be allowed to marry. Faith-based adoption agencies will be permitted to deny placing children with gay parents. And Texans can now openly carry swords, a welcome development for the samurai in our midst. The special session of the legislature that Governor Abbott called was a disappointing end for cultural conservatives, however, concluding without property tax reform, a compromise on school finance, or the bathroom bill. Dan Patrick blamed Joe Strauss. Thank goodness Travis didn't have the speaker at the Alamo, Patrick said. He might have been the first one over the wall. The state did commit to continuing to study the high rate of maternal mortality, at the same time passing new restrictions on abortion and doing nothing to improve access to health care. The special session passed a law limiting local ordinances on trees, although it was not as comprehensive as the governor had wanted. Large cities will be required to hold elections for residents in areas targeted for annexation. These measures were part of a larger attempt to disempower cities, which Dan Patrick said were responsible for all the problems in America. The reason? Our cities are still controlled by Democrats. He cheerfully observed on the Fox Business Network that almost 1,000 Democrats were defeated running for the local state houses and state senate and governors and lieutenant governors. We own the turf, state by state, and Texas leads the way. Not addressed by the legislature was the low quality of education in Texas, which is near bottom nationally in most measures of overall achievement. Texas spends $10,000 a year per student, $2,500 below the national average, an indication of where education stands in terms of the state's priorities. Racism may play a role in the steadily decreasing state support for public schools, but whatever the motivation, the workforce of the future has already been handicapped. Texas also ranks low in terms of its infrastructure, the roads, dams, pipelines, parks, railroads, energy systems, wastewater treatment, and drinking water that modern civilization relies upon. It's not just a matter of aging structures and poor maintenance. For a state that is projected to double in population in 30 years, Texas has done little to prepare itself. For all of the boldness that Texans often boast of, there is timidity about confronting the challenges in front of us, but that's not the direction the social conservatives who rule the state are facing. They instinctively look backward to a time when homosexuals were unseen, minorities were powerless, abortion was taboo, business and industry were largely unregulated, and science stood respectfully in the shadow of religious belief. Texas is not alone in its assault on diversity, nor in its determination to shove government out of civic life, but without high-quality education and modernized infrastructure, the knowledge-based industries of the future will find other states and other countries in which to plant themselves. The refusal to face these challenges head-on seems to me not only imprudent, but decidedly un-Texan. Joe Strauss received a vote of no confidence by his own chapter of the Republican Party in San Antonio, a gesture repeated in a number of other caucuses in counties around the state. The ostensible reason was Strauss's failure to advance the Texas GOP platform. That platform includes demands that the U.S. government surrender all of its authority over abortion back to the states, and that, until then, federal laws permitting abortion be ignored, that U.S. senators be appointed by state legislatures rather than elected by the citizens, that the IRS, Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Education, and a number of other federal agencies be abolished or defunded, that traffic enforcement cameras be removed, that a photo ID be required of all voters, that the U.S. Supreme Court ruling permitting gay marriage be overturned, that Social Security be phased out, that federal gun laws be ignored, that the Federal Reserve System be abolished and precious metals be reinstituted as the standard for the U.S. dollar, that the minimum wage law be repealed, that the U.S. withdraw from the United Nations and from international trade agreements such as NAFTA, and that a high border wall be built along the Mexican border, wherever it is deemed effective and cost-efficient. This document is a template for the future agenda of the Republican Party, not just in Texas, but in the nation. Strauss seemed to give the rebellion in his party caucuses little thought. He promised to run for a record-breaking sixth term as Speaker. Then on the morning of October 25th, he held an impromptu press conference in his office and announced that he would not seek another term. "I didn't want to be one of those people who held on to an office just because he could," Strauss said. "There are new players and they deserve to have their voices heard." Perhaps he was bowing to the inevitable. The House Republican caucus was pushing a plan that would allow them to designate the candidate for the post, making Democratic votes irrelevant. Strauss's enemies were exultant. "We did it, Speaker. Strauss is gone," Jonathan Stickland tweeted. "The future of Texas has never looked brighter." Julie McCarty, the president of the Northeast Tarrant County Tea Party, a statewide organization headquartered in Fort Worth, took credit for Strauss's departure. "No, I will not allow Strauss to waltz off in celebrated thanks for his service," she wrote on her Facebook page. "I will be David. I will mount Goliath's head on a sword, the saber I was awarded by Empower Texans for being a grassroots hero, and I will dance. I will display this victory for all to see, for the birds to peck at, for my fellow warriors to recognize God's hand in delivering our enemy, and to be motivated that God is not done yet, for others who wish to follow in Goliath's footsteps to be warned what awaits them."
Chapter 11. Borderlands. The Texas-Mexico border begins in El Paso and runs 1,200 miles along the Rio Grande to Brownsville before what's left of the river dumps into the Gulf. Mexico defines Texas in a way that no other state experiences with any other nation. We are like a couple still living next door to each other after a particularly bitter divorce. Imagine the wealth and power that would have been Mexico's had Texas remained a part of it, a genuine rival to the gringo colossus. Our history and our populations are intermingled and complexly mirror each other. You'll find paired cities strung like beads on either side of the river, Del Rio and Ciudad Acuña, Laredo and Nuevo Laredo, McAllen and Reynosa, Brownsville and Matamoros. El Paso and Juarez are the ones most closely aligned. El Paso Street crosses the International Bridge and becomes Avenida Benito Juarez. Physically, it's one city, straddling a political and cultural divide that has never been bridged. Growing up in Texas, I was always aware of our festive and treacherous neighbor next door. As a young reporter, I wrote about the narcotics trade and came to appreciate the peril that my Mexican colleagues experienced while covering the crime and corruption in their country. They were often under death threats and many were actually killed. An Austin writer friend of mine was shot in Mexico City when his cab was hijacked. One can't understand Mexico without acknowledging the violence that is part of the atmosphere. Octavio Paz, the great Mexican poet, once cataloged the differences he observed between his country and mine. The North Americans are credulous and we are believers. They love fairy tales and detective stories, and we love myths and legends, Paz writes. They are optimists and we are nihilists, except that our nihilism is not intellectual but instinctive and therefore irrefutable. We are suspicious and they are trusting. We are sorrowful and sarcastic and they are happy and full of jokes. North Americans want to understand and we want to contemplate. They are activists and we are quietists. We enjoy our wounds and they enjoy their inventions. There is another distinction that Paz draws, this one between the North Americans' avoidance of death and the Mexicans' willingness to contemplate horror. The bloody Christ in our village churches, the macabre humor in some of our newspaper headlines, our wakes, the custom of eating skull-shaped cakes and candies on the Day of the Dead, are habits inherited from the Indians and the Spaniards and are now an inseparable part of our being. The first time I went to Mexico was on a family trip to the little fishing village of Topolobampo on the Pacific Ocean in the state of Sinaloa. We flew to El Paso, then caught a bus to Chihuahua City, and from there took the train across Copper Canyon in the heart of Tarahumara Indian country. I was 16. My sisters, Kathleen and Rosalind, were 14 and 11. This was the summer after the Kennedy assassination. I remember that because when we were at dinner one night in Mexico, an American couple at the table next to us overheard us talking about Texas and asked where in Texas we were from. When Daddy said, Dallas, they got up and just left their meal sitting there. Before the trip, I had a startling nightmare, one of the worst dreams I've ever had in my life. I was on an airplane, and suddenly I was floating above my seat. I looked around to find my mother and saw her head come off. The next morning, I was sufficiently upset to tell Kathy and Roz about it. None of us had ever had a dream come true. And anyway, we were children, and what did we know about Mexico? So we went. On the way home, we retraced our steps, catching the train again at Los Mochis and crossing the Sierras to Chihuahua. Then we got on the bus to Juarez. I was trying to nap, with my head against the window. The road was empty, and the monotonous bleached landscape stretched out from nowhere to nowhere. It started sprinkling, and the drops shot across the window pane like bullets. We were going really fast. The road was wet, and when the driver came to a curve, he didn't even begin to make it. Suddenly, we were off the road, bouncing in our seats. Weirdly, the driver never slowed down. I heard later that he was 65 years old and had had his license for only 2 weeks, which might have accounted for the fact that he didn't simply stop and back up. Instead, he tried to navigate the bus back to the road, in a big loop through a field, going at the same wild clip, flying past cactus and over boulders. Ahead was a bridge crossing a dry arroyo. There was a slanted concrete abutment at the base of the bridge, which the driver hit, launching the bus into the air. It was then, as I was hurled into the luggage rack, that I looked back and saw my mother's wig come off. The bus flew across the road and landed with such force that everyone over 30 broke their backs. My sisters and I were the youngest passengers, and although we were shaken, we were able to stand and walk. We were in the middle of the Chihuahuan Desert. There were maybe 40 injured passengers. No cars on the road, no way to call an ambulance, nothing to do but wait for the next bus. The adults were splayed out on the floor or on their seats, groaning in pain. Daddy was stoic, but I could see he was suffering. My mother had also broken her breastbone and was gasping for breath. The driver was the most gravely injured. I later heard he went to prison. When the next scheduled bus finally came, about 4 hours later, we rode another 100 miles or so to Juarez, every bump in the road eliciting agonized choruses from the wounded passengers. It was sobering to hear the adults weeping. I didn't speak Spanish at the time, and I didn't understand why the police wouldn't let us take our parents to the hospital in El Paso. It turned out that accidents are often treated as crimes in Mexico, and we were all being held as witnesses. I returned to Juarez after Thanksgiving 2016. Mónica Ortiz Uribe, a freelance radio reporter in El Paso, accompanied me as we walked across the International Bridge. I like living in a place that allows me to experience both sides of myself, she told me. The Rio Grande here is little more than puddles inside a concrete culvert, nearly all the water having been diverted to farms on both sides. What is left runs through an irrigation canal paralleling the river. Mónica pointed out where a U.S. Border Patrol agent, who was on bike patrol, shot a 15-year-old boy just across the river about 60 feet away in 2010. According to American authorities, the boy was with a group who were throwing rocks at the agents, a frequent complaint. Because the bullet crossed an international boundary, the case is legally complicated. The U.S. Supreme Court recently heard arguments as to whether the agent who shot the boy can be sued and returned the case to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The cartel wars in Juarez made it the most dangerous city in the world between 2008 and 2012, even worse than Baghdad. More than 10,000 people were slain during that period. When Mónica and I visited, Juarez was experiencing another killing spree, with nearly 100 murders in October alone. Throughout Mexico, the homicide rate had surged 18% over the previous year. Everyone on both sides of the river was on edge. Downtown Juarez was desolate. Mónica pointed out the pink crosses on the lampposts. Since the 1990s, hundreds of Juarez women, most of them teenagers, have been kidnapped, many of them in plain sight on the streets where we were standing. Some of their bodies have turned up in mass graves. Each of the crosses on the lampposts represents one of the missing women. Now you can hardly find a street lamp without one, Mónica remarked. Women are still disappearing to this day, dozens every year. Meanwhile, across the river, El Paso bills itself as one of the safest cities in America. Border towns are typically crammed with local cops, U.S. Marshals, Border Patrol agents, and members of the Texas National Guard. Sometimes, however, bullets from gunfights in Juarez fly over the border. In 2012, a woman was pushing a stroller in downtown El Paso when a stray shot hit her in the leg. Bullets from Mexico also struck a building at the University of Texas branch in El Paso, and another broke a picture frame in the city hall. I checked into the Camino Real Hotel in downtown El Paso. My memory was that I had stayed here with my two sisters after the bus wreck while our parents were still in the hospital in Juarez, but as soon as I arrived, I realized that I had never been in this hotel before. I'm fascinated by the ways in which memory fails us, how vivid incidents can be distorted or lost, or repressed, to use Freud's term. I had never forgotten the bus wreck, or the sight of my parents in the Mexican hospital entirely encased in body casts. But there were details that had dropped away after 50 years. I recall that I had to hire a lawyer to get a writ that would let my parents leave Mexico. One of the first words I learned in Spanish was abogado, but I was at a loss about why I couldn't remember the hotel. I called my sisters. We were never in El Paso, Roz told me. We were always in Juarez. She thought we were there for a week or 10 days after the wreck. The hotel wouldn't let me make an international call to contact people who could help us, so we were trapped. You finally went to a bank and told them that your father was a banker too, and they let you use the phone, Roz said. That must have been when I called our family doctor, Robert Cox. He came down on a private plane to ferry our parents back to Dallas. Dr. Cox was a giant, about 6'7" or 6'8", and he towered over the Mexican doctors in my parents' hospital room. He had asked me to find an extra-long bed at the hotel for him, which I couldn't do. Kathy remembered that he came with a wad of dollars, which he spread around in the hospital and at the border to ease us all out of the country. Why did I have this memory of being at the Camino Real? I think there's another hotel by that name in Juarez, Kathy said. I remember because I stole the room key. She was right. As soon as she mentioned the key, I recalled the baronial keys and the archways and Saltillo tiles of the hotel we had actually stayed in. Kathy asked if I would repay the hotel for the stolen key. Apparently, it had weighed on her conscience all this time. Kathy told me another thing that I had forgotten. On the flight home, Dr. Cox called the three of us together as Mother and Daddy lay sedated on their gurneys. He told us that our parents were going to be invalids for the rest of their lives, Kathy said.
It may have had something to do with their bodies atrophying inside those body casts. He said we might not even be able to finish high school. You'd think I would have remembered that.
When we got to Baylor Hospital in Dallas, the casts were cut away and our parents were encouraged to move around. They wore braces for a long time, but they recovered. I wonder what happened to all those other passengers. Downtown El Paso is in the middle of a renaissance. The city had been devastated by the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, in 1994, which eliminated most tariffs between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Until then, much of the city's economy derived from the garment industry, but those jobs jumped over the border into the maquiladoras. The factories that are allowed to import certain materials for assembly or manufacturing and then return them to the United States as finished products. The goal of NAFTA was to draw Mexico into the high-wage economies of its northern neighbors and turn the entire North American continent into a single market. The Mexican president at the time, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, said that it would transform his country's economy so that it would export goods, not people. Donald Trump has decried NAFTA as the worst deal ever, and it's true that the agreement has had a mixed record for the United States and Mexico. In 1993, the balance of trade showed a narrow $1.7 billion U.S. surplus over Mexico. By 2016, after more than 20 years of NAFTA, that surplus has swung to a $64 billion deficit, the highest it has ever been. About 350,000 auto workers lost their jobs in the United States, while about 430,000 such jobs were created in Mexico. Texas alone lost nearly 50,000 jobs in the two decades after NAFTA's passage, about 18,500 of them in El Paso. Some economists argue that the American jobs would have been lost in any case because of globalization and automation, and that, in fact, the linkages with cheaper labor in Mexico gave American automakers an advantage in dealing with China. In any case, the percentage of Mexicans living below the poverty level, about 46% of the population, remains at roughly the same level it was when the trade deal was passed, and unemployment has actually risen. Almost 2 million Mexican farmers have been put out of work, unable to compete with their industrialized American counterparts. That has driven many of them to cross the border seeking better jobs. Cheaper goods have kept inflation down in the United States, but wages have also been slow to grow. Both countries have witnessed unprecedented levels of income inequality. I completely understand the fear that comes from NAFTA. We lived it, Veronica Escobar, then a county judge in El Paso, told me. When the manufacturing left after NAFTA, El Paso became a ghost town. Now, she says, we've reinvented ourselves. El Paso has adapted in part by servicing the maquiladoras across the border. There's a new medical school and a children's hospital in town. Hundreds of millions of dollars are being invested in renovating landmark buildings downtown. But the manufacturing jobs never returned. 7 out of the top 10 employers in the city are telemarketing call centers. Across the river in Juarez, 300 maquiladoras make parts and equipment for Bosch, Foxconn, Flextronics, Delphi, Lear, Boeing, Sumitomo, and other multinational corporations. Meanwhile, Mexico has raised the minimum wage to 70 pesos a day, less than 4 U.S. dollars. I got a tour of El Paso with Max Grossman, a professor of architectural history and a member of the local historical commission. He's a trim man with a snap-brim fedora, like a film noir character. In 1920, El Paso was the largest city between Dallas and San Francisco, Max said, as he pointed out some of the highlights of the city. The Plaza Hotel, formerly a Hilton, was where 17-year-old Elizabeth Taylor stayed before she was briefly married to Conrad Hilton, Jr. In the window of the oldest building downtown, now a pawn shop, was the blackened mummified trigger finger of Pancho Villa, the Mexican Revolutionary General, which was on sale for $9,500. Nearby was the office building where the gunslinger John Wesley Hardin had his law practice before he was shot in the back in a saloon. El Paso was legendary for its lawlessness, Max said happily. There were the handsome concrete Caples building where Francisco Madero planned the Mexican Revolution, and the CVS pharmacy, formerly the elite confectionery, where Pancho Villa indulged in strawberry sodas and peanut brittle. Afterwards, we had dinner next door to a hotel where John Dillinger spent the night. Monica and I drove out to a well-known crossing spot in the desert just west of El Paso. A massive fence was under construction. There are already nearly 700 miles of fence along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. As a result of the 2006 Secure Fence Act, passed during the George W. Bush administration, this stretch was not yet completed. It was dark and cold. As we crossed the railroad track, we ran into a couple of Border Patrol agents who told us it had already been a very busy night. We caught two different groups of 40 to 50 people and another group of 20, one of the agents said. The next day, Monica and I rode with another Border Patrol agent, George Gomez. He grew up in the region at a time when the border was completely open. I would go out to shoot jackrabbits with a BB gun, he said, as we passed through the sandy hills. I'd see hundreds of people coming across on a daily basis. There'd be landscapers, carpenters, maids. In the evening, you'd see them going back. El Paso was basically an open border. There was a barrier then, of sorts, a cable running through upright railroad ties. But people just stepped over it. Folks on both sides thought of themselves as citizens of the border, as if it were a region, not a boundary. The border was what they had in common. It united them and made them distinct from their countrymen farther away. In many respects, that's still true. Whenever I'm on the border, I hear the resentment against authorities whose job is to enforce the laws. Because of the language skills required, a large portion of the Border Patrol workforce is Hispanic. Many border people see them as traitors. They despise us, really, Gomez told me. Kids throw rocks at them. Cartels sometimes issue a green light to assassinate particular officers. When Gomez is off duty and people ask what he does for a living, he tells them he's an assistant baseball coach. In 1984, in response to a large influx of immigrants, the United States put up a chain-link fence that offered negligible deterrence. Sometimes we'd apprehend the same individual three or four times a day, Gomez said. In the mid-1990s, the Border Patrol began cracking down, but the migrants created strategies to defeat the new enforcement, for instance, by forming a mob of dozens or hundreds, then charging all at once across the border and scattering every which way. We'd catch the kids and the grandmas, Gomez said. Once, while he was acting as a canine handler at a checkpoint, he uncovered a migrant who had been upholstered to resemble a captain's chair in a van. If it hadn't been for the dog, no one would have noticed. Despite the recent increase in illegal crossings, the trend has been declining drastically for a decade. In 2006, in the El Paso sector, there were 122,256 apprehensions, Gomez said. In 2015, apprehensions dropped to 14,495 before rising again. El Paso prosecutes every individual who comes in, Gomez told me as we headed west on I-10. They are going to be jailed, if even for a day. The average stay in the immigration detention centers is about 30 days, but those who challenge their deportation typically remain in detention for months or even years. According to Gomez, those who have gotten court dates a year or two in the future often disappear into America. Right now, there's no way of tracking them. They just get lost. The backlog in the immigration courts is about 2 years. Historically, the vast majority of detainees are Mexican citizens, but in 2014, the balance shifted to Central Americans, including an alarming increase in unaccompanied minors. Gang violence in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, among the most violent countries in the world, has created a spike in asylum seekers. A fifth of the population of El Salvador is now living in the U.S., another guard told me. Nearly 45,000 migrants from Guatemala were picked up in Texas in the first 8 months of 2016. Many of them speak only Indian languages, confounding immigration officials and legal services. Gomez took us up on a hilltop above a landfill. We were now standing in the southeast corner of New Mexico. From there, we had a clear view of the Texas-Mexico border as it runs toward the Gray Mountains. There were two parallel highways, I-10 on the American side, and Carretera Anapra-San Jerónimo on the Mexican side. The sprawling suburbs of Juarez mirrored the American community to the north, as we watched a Union Pacific freight double-stacked with shipping containers filled with goods from the maquiladoras of Juarez, headed west toward Los Angeles. Between the two countries runs the new fence, like an industrialized Cristo installation. There are actually two kinds of fences, one for vehicles, which is really just a metal rail running between concrete-filled pylons, and one for pedestrians. It is 18 feet high and covered with a fine mesh that makes it difficult to get a grip. Yet people still come through. They use rope, grappling hooks, ladders, garden hoses. Some even use screwdrivers and scale it like Spider-Man, Gomez said. But once a person gets over the top, he has to jump down, risking a broken leg or a jammed knee. Drug smugglers usually drive through the desert where the fence is low. Sometimes they use plasma cutters to slice through the barrier rail and then carefully weld it back together and erase the tire tracks. The towering pedestrian fences pose a greater challenge for vehicles. They'll use ramps, Gomez says. One time he saw a Jeep that was stranded on top of the fence. It had to be lifted off by crane. From our perch on the hilltop, Gomez pointed out the glint of the windshields of Border Patrol agents in strategic vantage points lying in wait. One was stationed in a parking lot at a shopping mall. Another was near a cypress tree in a spot informally called Two Cup because the homeowner always offers coffee when he sees an agent. Torre's Windmill was named after an agent who was injured. Backpacker's Corner is a spot on the slope of Mount Cristo Rey on the horizon. There are sensors buried all around, high-intensity stadium lights, and usually helicopters swooping overhead. Still, thousands continue to cross the Texas border every month. Undocumented migrants who make it into Texas are trapped inside a ribbon about 50 miles wide, defined by checkpoints, 23 of them, on every road leading away from the border. They call that strip between the border and the checkpoints La Huala, the cage. Many choose to stay within that perimeter, unwilling to go back to Mexico or to take the risk of venturing farther into the United States. Often their families are just a few miles away in Mexico. I spoke to Will Hurd, who represents the massive 23rd Congressional District, which stretches from the west side of San Antonio to the edge of El Paso. His district is larger than most states east of the Mississippi and contains 820 miles of Texas's border with Mexico. A former undercover CIA agent who now serves on the Intelligence Committee in the House, Hurd is the first black Republican elected to Congress from the state, although the district is 70% Hispanic. He is also one of the few Republicans in Congress to speak against the construction of a wall. The cost is estimated to be anywhere between $12 billion to $40 billion, he said, citing a study by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The entire U.S. intelligence budget is $53 billion. He agrees that in densely populated areas, a physical barrier makes sense, but he thinks the hundreds of miles of remote Chihuahuan desert would be better protected, and far more cheaply, by sensors and drones. Hurd does not believe that a wall would stop the flow of drugs from Mexico into the United States. It's a $50 billion business, and you're not making that amount of money by sending cocaine across the border in some kid's book bag. You're bringing it across in vehicles, in fixed-wing aircraft, and submersibles. The wall doesn't address that. He says it's more effective to work with Mexican police and intelligence counterparts, focusing on drug kingpins, in order to stop the flow of narcotics before it reaches the U.S. border. But such close cooperation depends on good relations between the two countries. Hurd is especially worried about the future of NAFTA. Mexico is Texas's number one trading partner, he says. If NAFTA were to be overturned, Texas would be especially hard hit. The trade imbalance is only one indicator of the relationship. It doesn't take into account the service industries. It doesn't take into account the people from Monterrey who come to San Antonio to shop. Our relations are too complex to boil down to a single number. There are two narratives about what the border is, Fernando Garcia, the founder of the Border Network for Human Rights, told me. The farther away you are, the more chaotic and violent it appears. But when you live at the border, there's a different reality. Alarmed by the increasing militarization along the border and the abuses that were taking place against undocumented migrants, Garcia began organizing the immigrant community and informing people of their rights. He says he has found a surprisingly willing partner in the El Paso sector of the Border Patrol, which reviews every case of abuse that Garcia's organization collects, and as a result, complaints have decreased substantially. One of the projects Garcia has worked on with the Border Patrol is called Hugs, Not Walls. For a few brief minutes, families on both sides of the Rio Grande line up. Those on the American side, many of them undocumented immigrants, wear blue T-shirts, and those on the Mexican side wear white. Then, at a signal from the Border Patrol, they walk down the sides of the culvert into the muddy riverbed. Many of them are weeping even before they meet. Then they fall into embraces and take photos. 400 families were brought together in the first two events. A third hug took place in February 2017, days after the newly inaugurated President Trump issued an executive order to build a wall on the border. I spoke to several women who participated. One had been living in El Paso and hadn't seen her father and siblings for 16 years. Another woman said she and her husband had been living together in El Paso for 27 years until he was arrested for drinking and driving and was sent back to Mexico. A third woman has a daughter who is one of the Dreamers, who grew up in America and hopes to gain citizenship. Our situation is precarious under the new administration, the woman said. We're living in the shadows now. One can't live in Texas without being aware of those shadow people. They tread a line that the rest of us scarcely acknowledge. At any moment, everything can be taken away, and they are thrown back into the poverty, violence, and desperation that drove them to leave their native lands and take a chance living an underground life. I thought about the Sanctuary Cities Bill in September 2017, when a 28-year-old Mexican national, Juan Coronilla Guerrero, was assassinated in a gang-ridden town in central Mexico. He had been living in Austin with his wife. He was picked up at the Travis County Courthouse in March when he responded to misdemeanor charges of assault and possession of marijuana. He was one of those whom Sheriff Sally Hernandez had refused to hold for federal immigration authorities because he had not committed a sufficiently serious offense. His wife had warned a federal judge that her husband would be killed if he were sent back to Mexico. Other Mexican nationals detained by U.S. immigration authorities have pleaded to be deported anywhere other than across the Texas border, where the Zetas, one of the most brutal of the drug cartels that run much of Mexico, lie in wait for them, routinely kidnapping them for ransom, but often winding up killing them instead. The violence and criminality does spill over the border. In the last 5.5 years in Texas, Dan Patrick told Fox Business News, we've apprehended over 212,000 criminal aliens. We've charged them with nearly 600,000 crimes, including over 1,000 murders, 6,000 sexual assaults, 90,000 other crimes, hundreds of kidnappings. We have to stop sanctuary cities, secure the border, and make America great again. I have spent much of my professional life writing about terrorism. I believe in secure borders. There is good reason to worry about having a vast class of people inside our country who are made criminals simply by their presence. I understand, but do not condone their actions. We are complicit in their suffering, however. We take advantage of their weakness, their lack of standing or recourse. The shadow people provide the cheap labor that border states especially depend upon. They are not slaves, but neither are they free. Chapter 12. The High Lonesome. You don't get to Wink, Texas by accident. It's 60 miles west of Odessa, tucked below the corner of New Mexico, on a two-lane blacktop passing through the aptly named hamlet of No Trees and a town called Kermit after the son of Theodore Roosevelt, who once came to hunt antelope. 7 miles south of Kermit is Wink. It is one of the many near ghost towns stranded by an oil boom that came and went. In the 1920s, 30,000 people lived here. Wink was a den of gambling and prostitution run by the mob. Those times are long gone, like tumbleweeds blown away in the wind. Wink now is as close to nowhere as you can get and still be on pavement. Downtown is made up of a handful of buildings, mostly shuttered, except for the one-story cinder block structure sporting the word museum. It's this modest building that draws pilgrims like me. On the front door of the Roy Orbison Museum is a number to call if you want to be let in. Walter Quigley answered and said he'd be right over. "Do you smell that?" Walter asked as he unlocked the door. He pointed to the awning above us. "Bats," he said. "There was a gap up there and several hundred of them got into that space. When they flew out the other evening, I sealed it up, but evidently there are still a bunch in there." Inside the single-room museum was a small collection of artifacts and photos of Roy at different stages of his life, along with album covers and posters. Above the door was a beat-up guitar that Roy once played, which had been hanging in a friend's garage for 40 years. As a teenager, Roy was dumpy, pale as a biscuit, and nearly blind. In high school, he began dyeing his cottony hair black so he didn't look like an albino. Still, he was picked on incessantly. "The students here would treat him so rotten dirty," Walter said. "I won't repeat what they said to him." Walter put on a CD of one of Roy's albums. There's so much pain and longing in those songs, "Crying," "Dream Baby," "Oh Pretty Woman," and especially "Only the Lonely." You can feel the rejection pulsing through his soaring, spectral voice, which filled up the little museum, along with the occasional squeak of a dying bat. After I moved to Texas, I became a musician. I was 38.5 years old and determined to play Great Balls of Fire on my 40th birthday. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. I'm still taking piano lessons, and although I'll never be a great player, I'm in a band called Hoodoo. We play blues and rockabilly. Our set list is populated with songs by Texas musicians, including Stevie Ray Vaughan, Muddy Waters, Buddy Holly, T-Bone Walker, and, of course, the great Roy Orbison. "Only the Lonely, dum-dum-dum-dum-dee-doo-wah, Know the way I feel tonight. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That song came out in 1960. I was in the 7th grade in Abilene, Texas. I had never heard anything exactly like it. Roy's operatic 3-octave voice on a country ballad, married to doo-wop and infused with the existential solitude of the West Texas plains. An unhappy man with a thrilling and unmistakable voice, our Edith Piaf. One of my bandmates, Brian Turner, who sings Roy's version of Mean Woman Blues to close out our show, had tipped me off to ask Walter about the sacred relic, the object of the pilgrim's journey. Walter hesitated, then reached under the display case and pulled out a wooden box, wrapped in a sweatshirt. Inside the box were Roy's trademark tinted eyeglasses, black plastic frames with bifocal lavender lenses. I put them on. When I was in high school in Dallas, my friends and I would drive around aimlessly for hours, mesmerized by a late-night broadcast on WRR called Cat's Caravan. It played early rhythm and blues, otherwise known as race music, by such great Texas bluesmen as T-Bone Walker, Lightnin' Hopkins, and Leadbelly. You can draw a line from those musicians to Janis Joplin, who took the Texas blues and used it to supercharge rock and roll. Another trajectory would go from R&B through mariachi to arrive at Selena, or through pop to discover Beyoncé. Texas is a great scrambler of cultural forms. My piano teacher, Floyd Domino, is a boogie-woogie master. He has 2 Grammys, and he's played with George Strait, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and many other country stars. He is known for mixing Oscar Peterson with Western swing. He's been teaching me now for 2 decades. I'm talentless, but persistent. I know classical pianists who can trace their training through their teacher and their teacher's teachers all the way back to Beethoven. I asked Floyd where our tradition comes from. Al Strickland, he said. As Floyd tells it, Strickland, from Antioch, Texas, the Antioch that is in Johnson County, there have been as many as 15 Antiochs in Texas, was a self-taught jazz pianist who was influenced by hearing Earl Father Hines and his smooth Chicago-style swing on the radio. In 1927, when Strickland was working at a radio station in Fort Worth, 3 musicians came in for an audition. One of them carried a fiddle in a flour sack. He introduced himself as Bob Wills from Hall County in the Panhandle. "What kind of music do you play?" Strickland asked. "Different," said Wills. Wills promised he would come back and hire Strickland as his piano player one day when he formed a real band. In the meantime, Wills and his players formed the Light Crust Doughboys, backing up Pappy O'Daniel on his radio show. They were wildly popular, but O'Daniel was a tyrant, and Wills had a drinking problem. After O'Daniel fired him, Wills formed another band that became known as the Texas Playboys. In 1935, Strickland joined the group. The fusion of Chicago jazz, frontier fiddle, and the blues that Bob Wills learned from his black playmates in the cotton fields constituted the fundamental elements of Western swing. My own band once got to play with Johnny Gimble, who was a fiddle player in the Playboys. I felt that I had been inducted into a fraternity that I didn't really qualify for. I asked Floyd what characterizes the Texas sound. "First of all, it's riff-based," he said. "Riffs are brief musical figures that are stated and restated and explored over different chord changes. Musicians talk about being in the pocket, which Floyd explains is not a spot, it's an area. Texas music tends to be played on the backside of the groove. You can hear that in the blues shuffles of the Vaughn Brothers, T-Bone Walker, Johnny Winter, ZZ Top, and Red Garland, a kind of relaxed, almost too late stutter step." Floyd grew up in Berkeley, California, in an academic Jewish household, but his ear was captured by the sounds of Western swing. To the despair of his parents, he ran off and joined a band, Asleep at the Wheel, led by Ray Benson, then in Oakland, which was dedicated to keeping that music alive. Bob Wills was their inspiration, and Al Strickland became Floyd's mentor. Willie Nelson invited the band to move to Austin in 1974. Floyd's real name is Jim Haber. The stage name was thrust upon him by a couple of his Asleep at the Wheel cohorts who had analyzed his style of playing, which in their minds was a combination of Floyd Kramer, the father of country piano, and Fats Domino, the New Orleans R&B king. "When Ray introduces you tonight, he's going to call you Floyd Domino," one of them said. It was supposed to be an experiment, but as soon as Jim walked off the stage, everyone started calling him Floyd. It just stuck. A decade later, when Floyd was touring with Waylon Jennings, he decided he wanted his real name back. The production manager called the band together and told him, "Floyd's real name is Jim, and from now on, that's what he wants you to call him. Ain't that right, Floyd?" Joe Ely, a singer-songwriter friend of mine, marched me through an immense Walmart in Lubbock. We walked toward the rear of the store, past the appliances and ladies' clothing, until we arrived at the diapers. Joe turned to the baby strollers and said, "Here, right here, was Buddy Holly's house." Lubbock and the stretch north through the Texas Panhandle produced so many great musicians. Waylon Jennings came from Littlefield, Jimmy Dean from Plainview, the Gatlin brothers and Tanya Tucker from Seminole. Lubbock itself produced Sonny Curtis, Mac Davis, Delbert McClinton, Gary P. Nunn, Lloyd Maines and his daughter Natalie. There's a long list of singers who continue to make music that comes out of the cotton fields and oil rigs and somehow spreads all over the world. Joe is part of that tradition. He reminds me of Bruce Springsteen, whom he's toured with. He's a roots rocker who sings about the people he grew up with, making anthems out of their lives. His songs blend country and honky-tonk and Mexican corridos into a distinctive regional sound. You often hear him playing with his fellow Lubbock musicians, Jimmy Dale Gilmore and Butch Hancock, in a group called the Flatlanders. He is also part of Los Super Seven, along with Freddie Fender, Lyle Lovett, Flaco Jimenez, and a changing cast of other mostly Texas musicians. I sometimes sing one of Joe's songs, Fingernails, with Hoodoo. Joe and I rode down Broadway, the red brick main street, past the only skyscraper in Lubbock, the 20-story Great Plains Life Building, which sat empty for years after being hit by a tornado in 1970. "You can see it's still a little twisted," Joe pointed out. There's a vacant lot where his father's Disabled American Veterans thrift store used to be, across the street from where several Mexican dance halls in the old warehouses once stood. "I was a young kid, but there was music on every corner," Joe said, "with accordions and bajo sextos and even horn sections. There couldn't be bars because Lubbock was dry." I asked Joe what made Lubbock such a musical town. "I don't know about others, but I think all the emptiness made me want to fill it up," he said. We drove out to the cemetery and got a groundskeeper to show us Buddy Holly's modest grave, a flat tombstone, the inscription spelled Holly, H-O-L-L-E-Y, his actual family name. There were several guitar picks left there by visiting musicians. "I brought the Clash here when they played Lubbock," Joe recalled. "We stayed all night in the graveyard until the sun came up, sitting around, singing songs, drinking beer." Joe and I marveled at the brief span of Buddy's life, 1936 to 1959. He was 22 years old when he took that fateful airplane ride with Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper on a snowy night in Iowa. "All his recordings were done over a period of 18 months," Joe said. "His early stuff was bluegrass, and then rockabilly came along. It was Elvis and Carl Perkins that inspired him." We headed out Highway 84 to the Cotton Club, a roadhouse 15 miles outside of town. The club has gone through many hands and burned down several times. Joe himself owned it for a while. It's a one-story clapboard building, an elongated shack, really, but at one time it was considered the most important venue between Dallas and Los Angeles. Johnny Cash, Tex Ritter, Fats Domino, and Benny Goodman appeared there. Bob Wills performed every Friday night. Then in 1955, a cultural tornado arrived in the form of Elvis Presley. The daughter of the club owner used to let young musicians like Buddy Holly and Mac Davis slip in through the kitchen to hear Elvis whenever he came to play. Waylon Jennings and Roy Orbison were transfixed by his performances. Elvis married country music to rhythm and blues, race music, and turned on a sexual faucet that drenched the Baptist and Church of Christers in unholy waters. After hearing Elvis, Buddy Holly went home and wrote his first rock and roll song, Not Fade Away. We still play it in our band. See, this is the back door, Joe said as we approached the club from the grass parking lot. Elvis's Cadillac would have been right about here. Supposedly, he signed some girl's panties and her boyfriend beat him up and stuck a rag in the gas tank and burned up his Cadillac. Joe recalled another Lubbock musician who went to high school with him, Norman Odom, a gawky kid who would stand on the stoop of the schoolhouse at 7 a.m. before classes began and sing at the top of his lungs. Kids would throw pennies at him, which Odom gathered for his lunch money. He began calling himself Legendary Stardust Cowboy. He actually recorded a few songs with Mercury Records, including Paralyzed. It's 3 minutes of screaming at the top of his lungs played on a G7 chord, said Joe. It nails you to the wall. T-Bone Burnett was on drums. They made some test pressings and sent them to the Dallas stations, and within a week it was getting more play than the Beatles. Legendary Stardust sank as quickly as he rose, but his persona influenced David Bowie, who modeled his Ziggy Stardust character on him and actually covered a couple of his incoherent songs. That evening, Joe played a solo acoustic set at the Cactus Theater in downtown Lubbock. The place was filled with friends and fans, and Joe was in a ruminative frame of mind. Growing up in Lubbock, you had to sort of make your own entertainment, he said, and the audience laughed knowingly. My parents had friends who owned the dry cleaning store. We'd go out to the lake for a picnic after church, and then we'd go in the back door of the dry cleaners, and they'd let us kids try on other people's clothes. There was no greater thrill. I wish I had a song about that. I drove south, descending from the high plains into Post, the erstwhile utopian community established by the cereal maker C.W. Post at the turn of the 20th century. He was defeated, like so many others, by the absence of rain, although he used to set off dynamite charges on the mesas every 10 minutes for several hours a day with the goal of pulling moisture out of the sky. One can imagine the effect on the other utopians. It feels ominous to drive through West Texas with a clean windshield. Road trips always used to be accompanied by the incessant splatter of death. We'd pass through clouds of love bugs, those perpetually copulating critters, which coated the windshield in a greenish sheen, and then the grasshoppers would hit in blobs of orange-yellow goo. Painted ladies and Miller moss and June bugs contributed their own colorful innards. Wipers only made things worse. The whole front of the car would be peppered with insect carcasses, and the Texas sun baked them into a buggy frittata. They were hell to wash off. I remember scrubbing the grill and never getting it clean enough. Truckers especially would protect their radiators with mesh shields. Bugs were simply part of the Texas air. Now when I collide with a bug, I'm surprised. I can only speak for Texas, but the absence of insects seems to be a part of a general diminution of life. The fence lines along our roadsides used to be ornamented with scissortail flycatchers, those elegant acrobats, so rare now that the insects have disappeared. Steve remembers the sound of turtles being scrunched as tires rolled over them. This was at a time when so many were crossing the road it was hard to thread a route through them. The inventory of life forms is being funneled down to a roster of hardy pests. We're living in a world of mosquitoes, roaches, fire ants, starlings, rattlesnakes, and feral hogs. In fairness to the animals, I suppose I should add humans to the top of the list. Snyder is home to the white buffalo statue in front of the courthouse. The white buffalo is a kind of totem for me. In 1955, the same year Elvis came to the Cotton Club, I was in the third grade in Ponca City, Oklahoma. There was a seminal episode of The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, in which Rusty, the orphan who was being raised by a troop of soldiers at Fort Apache, saves the life of an Indian. As every boy my age knew, if you save an Indian's life, he's obliged to follow you around until he can return the favor. The Indian in question happened to be on a spirit